Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, folks. Lorianne, are you there?
I sure am.
Hello.
Holy geez, do we have an echo.
Woo.
You hear it?
Yeah, I do. Hang on. Okay, is this better?
Yeah, no echo now. Sounds good.
Okay, good.
Okay.
It's a direct connect, because I mute it, but then once the show starts, sometimes it still picks up my mic, so I have to unmute and mute again on the direct connect anyway. So
Okay. Hello,
Montana Joe. How you doing?
All righty, okay. And how are you doing?
I am hanging in there. I am ready to go. Hopefully we have a good show. It looks like we got Joe Gibson in the chat room. Hopefully we get some people calling in as well to talk about tonight's topic of conversation.
Well, we'll probably get a couple. But I would bet that if we were to continue this for next week or whenever the next time that we have a show about the same topic, we'll probably have more people because of the people who would be coming in here tonight would probably find it somewhat interesting and show up the next time. And those people who haven't shown up tonight will probably possibly show up next time. But in any case, folks, this is the Joe from Montana Show, featuring also my capable co-host, Lorianne, who has her own show called The Lucid Libertarian on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And so that those who are downloading the show tonight don't have to wait until the end of the show in order to find out how to call in next time. The number is 646-478-5284. And again, that number is 646-478-5284. And outside of by my saying hello to Lorianne, hello, Joe. Oh, you must have been driving around BTR trying to find some interesting shows, came across this one, or maybe you found out from Lorianne's Facebook page. However you
yes,
found out.
Yes, sent me a message.
Okay. So,
what's the topic?
The topic is about bad bosses, our experiences with bad bosses and or bad colleagues, how much of a pain in the ass that they are. This isn't a political show tonight. This is going to be about personal experiences. So,
well,
I'm
my
sure.
Personal experience.
Okay.
Do you want to hear about personal experiences of having to work with people?
Absolutely.
Yes,
go for it.
The bad boss, bad coworkers, all that good jazz. You know, the people that make our lives hell on the job.
Yeah.
On the job. Well.
On the job or any other place, but on the job first. So, okay,
well,
Joe.
You know where I worked at one time in my life. I worked for the government, three-letter agency, and worked actually with the gang intelligence community and government workers and whatnot and state police in the state of Connecticut undercover. And I guess you could say I had some coworkers there.
Well, you definitely had some colleagues, yeah. And if you want to talk about them, because I wanted to talk to you in private about that. And if you want to talk about how these assholes, for all practical purposes, either set you up or did not have your back, that is something most people should really know about.
Oh yeah, I've been trying to tell that story for years. I mean, you know, but they were my way. They were. I worked with them and. You know, I had a guy that worked with me. He was supposed to be, I thought he was a friend, you know, was going to watch my back and have me, you know, protect me. And, you know, and the evidence shows that he pretty much probably sold me out. And, you know, I ended up getting my throat slashed open, you know, 16 staples. That was the first murder attempt. The second one was a probation officer that set me up on the streets. I was getting out of my car and three guys surrounded me. And it was definitely a professional hit. And wham, slammed me in the chest with a knife and went out the other side of my body and almost killed me. You know, I thought I was going to die that night. for sure when I was laying in the street. But, you know, but working with these people, you know, since to stay on the topic, working with these people side by side, you know, you would you put your trust, you know, my life is in their hands, you know.
Absolutely.
And I'm thinking, well, you know, and they let me down. They violated that trust.
Absolutely. That is something that you should get out there to the public, because people have to know about our particular government. They have to know that the government not only is incompetent, which a lot of people know about, but it's downright untrustworthy. Here you put your life in their hands, and what do? They've practically
pulled
the knife.
Well, it happened again,
themselves.
Joe. See, I don't learn, I guess, you know, and I don't know if I really should be discussing this, but, you know, I've worked for the DEA. You know, getting people, arresting people on narcotics. I was training narcotics officers in this state, actually, how to make undercover buys. And they shit on me again, pretty much. You know, so it's an ongoing process that, you know, the government cannot be trusted. You know, you try to do the right thing, you know. And that's why when I watched that movie, Sounds of Freedom, it inspired me. I'm like, wow, I should use my connections, and I should go undercover like this guy. But you know what? I'll end up getting sold out or something and left on an island someplace, dead. You know, and that's what will happen, because that's how this government operates. Unless I, you know, unless I'm a private contractor and do it on my own. It's the only way. Because, you know, it's insane. It's insanity. Because you can't trust these public officials. You can't. Either they get bought off, or they sell you out, or corruption. It just seems that anyone's heart true and sincere in what they're doing. Yes, there's sincere people out there trying to save people's lives and protect people and protect the general public. And there's groups and organizations that do things that we're not supposed to talk about for the old, good, old, mighty freedom that everyone gets to enjoy today. That, you know, this cloud of freedom, the bubble that Americans get to live in, and they don't know what happens in the behind the know, you know, the people in the know who see the dirty stuff, you know, the drugs that are purposely transported into this country. You know, I was on a plane in 1991. I'm not working with them, but they were CIA, and they got freaking cocaine on the freaking military plane. I'm like, what the hell is this? Hey, you never saw that, you know? Yeah, landed right in the LAX airport, you know? And, you know, here come the white vans, pulling up, loading it off. I saw the whole thing, you know? Here in Greensboro, North Carolina, about 10 years ago, guns, vans, shipping guns down to Venezuela. You know? I mean, come on, man. You know? But I guess these are the things that have to happen for the business to go as usual, for us to enjoy our day-to-day lives. Because when you try to tell the story and you become a whistleblower, you become a target, and you get wiped out. You know? So it's best not to say things sometimes. But I'm the guy that likes to tell the truth. You know, I believe the truth will always set you free.
Well, I got a movie. I got a documentary for you. I was watching it, and it reminded me of you. Only you got to go to Tubi or wherever you can find this particular documentary. It's called White Boy. It's about a guy named White Boy.
Yep, in Detroit, right? He worked for the narcotics division of the police, and he ended up going to prison for many, many years, right?
No. What happened was, it was a kid who was the government and the media made this 17-year-old white boy who hung out with the black kids.
Yeah,
he went to jail for 28 years.
Yeah.
He went to jail at the age of 17. Yeah. So,
it happened in Detroit, Michigan. Detroit, Michigan, that's where it took place.
It was about corruption, how his lawyers sold them out, and, you know, stuff like that. So,
yeah. And
okay.
another movie to watch, another one, for just to throw it out there, Barry Seal, American Made with Tom Cruise. That's a true story, Barry Seal. We worked for Pablo Escobar, Carlos Slater, all those guys down there, and he was transporting cocaine into the country for the government, for Ronald Reagan. For the Reagan administration, Oliver North, you know, shipping cocaine in here. And then they set him up in the DEA, and they let him come in here, and they whacked him or whatever. I think he was dead. He was doing community service, and they came, and they just put so many darn holes in that guy that wasn't even funny. So, you know, but I survived it, thank God, so far. But they know. I've been trained. I know what to look for. I know what to see. and they come at me, they better know they come, you know, look, I survived 2 murder attempts already. Come on. You don't think they'd try a third, you know? I mean, you know,
well,
you're not,
you know,
Blair,
I want to talk to you in private about that and some other things. But like I said, tonight isn't going to be mainly about government because I'm tired of the chit-chat shows that are on BTR.
Well,
so I got bored, and so I thought I'd put on a show tonight. And Lorianne, I'm sure that you've got experiences with colleagues and bosses that you like to get off your chest. So if you do, you know, feel free.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, I think that's kind of, you know, why we decided on this topic, because, you know, we've all had our experiences. I think, you know, if we've ever been employed for somebody at various jobs, at some point, chances are pretty good that most of us have had a bad boss and or bad coworker in our time that made life hell for us. And I am no exception. You know, and I've had, you know, I think, you know, I've had bad bosses. I kind of went through a string of them at one point in my life. And it's hard to, like, you know, like, which one was the worst? But I think the one that comes to mind first is this was about 20 years ago or over 20 years ago now, probably. I had just gotten out of school, you know, getting my associate's degree in computers and, you know, PC support. And I was hired back to a company that I had originally worked for over 3 years and to replace their computer guy and to do, like, a complete overhaul of their systems, because, like, this computer guy, which he gets into the story about bad coworkers too, by the way, the guy that I replaced. Anyway,
right.
So before I get into that guy, I'll get into my past. So anyway, so I was heading up a complete overhaul, working my butt off, like every computer in the office. And then there was also 6 other smaller satellite offices. All of these computers were riddled with viruses. And I was behind a complete changeover, like reinstalling Windows on all of the computers, having technicians come in to redo all the wiring because all of the network wiring was old. And, like, I literally went up into the ceiling.
Right.
My boss's computer kept, you know, disconnecting and stuff. I mean, I worked my butt off. And so I reinstalled Windows on all of these computers except the boss's. My boss's computer was the only one. He would not allow me to reinstall Windows on his computer. And it was endless, you know, times trying to remove viruses and clean up his machine. And the reason why was because he was using his company computer for peer-to-peer file downloading, right? Downloading movies and stuff, most of which was porn. He was downloading porn galore all day, every day, you know, using, you know, the peer-to-peer file downloading, like torrents,
right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I kept trying to tell him, I'm like, you know, this is dragging the network down. And he was, he would not stop doing it. He would not let me reinstall Windows. And, you know, after investing all this money in a new switch and wiring and doing everything that I could, and people were still complaining about internet slowness and, you know, every time they needed to do something online, it was so slow. And eventually, whenever he went either out of town or he was going to spend the day at one of the satellite offices, I literally would go to the switch and I would unplug the network connection to his computer. And of course, miraculously, nobody would complain about the internet being slow. You know, whenever he was gone, it was like, you know, people started to, you know, say stuff like, oh, yay, today, you know, the internet's going pretty fast, you know. And so this became a thing, and, you know, whenever I knew he was coming back, then, of course, I would plug his network connection back in at Switch. And so eventually, you know, so he'd come back into the office, and again, people were still complaining. And one day, he brings me into his office, and he starts chewing me out because he's like, I'm so tired of all these people complaining about the network being slow, and I've spent all this money and invested all this, and, you know, and he's chewing me out for people complaining. And, you know, so I just finally had enough. And I literally told him, I'm like, well, maybe you should abide by your own computer use policy and stop downloading porn all day long, getting viruses on your computer and sucking up all the internet for everybody else in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe they'll stop complaining. He was so pissed. He was like red in the face pissed because I was calling him all out on it, man. I'm just like, it's your fault, you know? And then I told him, I'm like, every time you're gone, I unplug your internet connection and everybody's happy with the internet speed. It is you, it is your computer, and, you know, and you need to abide by your own policy. You need to let me reinstall Windows on this thing. You need to stop downloading porn, get a handle on your porn addiction, you know, and then life will get a lot better for everybody else here in the office. He was red
in
the
my
face
world,
just at me.
In my world, if you would have did that, we would have put a contract out on you.
Exactly.
We would make it disappear.
So, yeah, I was fired after that.
I didn't even hear what Joe was saying. It was both of you were talking at the same time. What'd you say, Joe?
I said, in my world, if she would have did that, we would have put a contract on her.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, well, thankfully that, I wasn't in that kind of a business.
Yeah. But I remember
the
story
thing
from
is, a few years later.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but a funny thing is, a few years later, I get this text message on my phone from a number I didn't recognize. And, you know, he's like, hey, Lorianne, it's been a long time. And I was like, who is this? And he's like, it's the asshole you used to work for.
Wow.
Did he say that or did he text? Did he say that?
He did.
He really did. He must have wanted you back. Yeah.
The asshole you used to work for. So, of course, I knew exactly who that was.
Yeah, that reminds me of my stories. I've worked for I've worked for some nice guys, and I've worked for some people who were, you know, have their egos in overdrive. But what I remember most about when I was working was, can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure the mic is working. Okay, cool. Is that I had been fired, how many, 5 times. Of those 5 times, 8 times I was fired, 5 of them wanted me back. So that was gratifying because when they fired me, it was because I had stepped up, spoken up about some of the policies that they were using that weren't exactly improving the bottom line nor the sales of the company. And, of course, everybody always says that they want progress, but they never want change along with progress. It's like saying I want to take a shower, but I don't want to get wet. So, but the thing about it was that eventually 5 of them had wanted me back because they realized that it's hard to find somebody who has a combination of the work ethic that I had plus the results that I had gotten as a salesman for the company. So that was nice. So mainly my memories, they are of some assholes I've worked for, but mainly the idiots, the nice people who may have known something about Business 101, Business 102, because they started their own business and they had the infrastructure in place. And they were up and running for a number of years. But when it came to sophisticated business operations or marketing, they didn't know shit. Excuse me. And as a result, I had to work with people who mainly, and I want to know from both of you if you've had, if you've ever had this on your job, and I'm sure that you too have had somebody say these same exact words of, we just don't do that around here. So that's what I used to hear on a number of jobs. We just don't do that around here. Even though I got hired one time to actually make changes, as soon as I got hired, I realized that the person hired me, not because they really wanted to make changes, but because of my expertise in sales in a particular area, telemarketing, and they wanted to limit my expertise in that area. So as a result, I didn't last long in that job. It was 30 days, and that was it. And then after that, that particular person didn't want me back per se, but was willing to have me work for them on a commission basis. But I said, nah, no thanks, you know. So it was, and then the business folded about 2 years later after I got fired. And the other businesses that I had worked for, they've all folded or merged. And it was just, it just seemed like an ongoing process of, God, yeah, we want progress. Yeah, but we just don't do that around here. You know, and it's so stupid. So though that basically sums up my particular story, you know. Other than people getting killed, what do you remember? What do you remember of the people that you work with, either the incompetence or the pain in the ass factor, the people that you work with that were just, you know, you wanted to kill but just didn't do
well,
it?
Well, yeah. Well, I opened up a landscaping business here in North Carolina when I relocated down here. You know, I had about 10 employees at one time, and it was just, you know, and I'm trying to get 3 trucks on the road, you know, and I just could never always have 3 on the road. It was always 2. Because if somebody would call out or their grandmother died 3 times, you know, I'm street
yeah.
smart, obviously, you know. So they're not going to run game on me, you know, and they don't know that. They don't know my past. And, you know, like I said, I've worked in the prison system. I mean, come on, every con, every criminal, every most violent people in the world I came in contact with. And, you know, so I've heard all the stories in the world. So when these people who aren't street smart come up and try to run game and con me, you know, they got a flat tire that broke down, or they were, I know they just got paid and they're out partying. I could tell their personality. So that's what I always ran into with. It was always incompetence because the work ethic or the caring about the business wasn't there from employees. You know, it was very hard to find somebody who cared about your business.
Yeah. And that's the perspective of a boss, you know, meaning you being the boss. And it is hard to find good workers, even if you treat them fairly. It's almost as though Americans, after going through the grill and the grind from the time you're about 21, you know, through 25 or so, and you've had a number of jobs, and you've had good bosses, good colleagues, bad colleagues. It's almost as though the wind is taken out of you, and unless you actually come across a company with a boss or a supervisor that really knows how to treat you fairly, most Americans or most workers really don't have much of an incentive to, you know, to really show initiative to do something in order to make the bosses know that, yeah, I've got value here. I want a raise based upon my merit. This I can say about the lovely little Lorianne, because she has initiative.
Uh-oh.
She's taken. No. It's not negative. I know I phrased it that way, but it's because she takes initiative in something like this, something like being a co-host and volunteering to write up the description page and the show title, et cetera. So I would imagine that you probably showed initiative on your real jobs, and yet maybe some bosses took you seriously, and maybe they didn't. You know, and I'm just saying that to talk about what I would just finish saying, is that a lot of Americans, when we go for a job, you know, at our beginning jobs, when we start out in our career bushy-eyed, I mean, wide-eyed, bushy-tailed, and then after a few years, we just say, oh, fuck it, I'm just waiting for lunchtime, you know? But if the boss
is... Yeah, I noticed that with a lot of employees.
Sometimes it doesn't even take years. It only takes a few months.
Yeah.
You know. So, I mean, if you guys... Any story that you guys have that come to mind as we're talking, just jump on in and talk about it, because this is a topic that a lot of people can relate to. Bad bosses, bad colleagues, hating to go to work in the morning. Well, wasn't there a survey done something like 15, 20 years ago, and something like 90% of the people who were employed said they hated their jobs, something like 86%, something like that?
That's terrible.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, and the biggest reason why is either because of usually management. You know, their own boss is a crappy boss. And I know for me personally, the bosses I've had the most issues with and struggled with the most are the micromanager type.
Yeah.
You know, where they just, you know, they're over your shoulder, they nitpick every little thing that you do and how you do it. And I just can't stand that. You know, I really cannot stand being micromanaged. It's like, I'm not a 5-year-old here. You don't have to control every single move I make and how I do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest problem that I had. And, you know, one of the, you know, I was fortunate in my last job. I had actually an excellent boss. I've had two really great bosses that were not micromanagers, that were just like, you know, here's what I expect of you. Here's your job. If I don't care how you do it, so long as the job
gets done,
it gets done on time and people are happy. If nobody's complaining about you, then I'm a happy camper, you know, and like they took that kind of hands-off approach. And yet they are also both approachable whenever I had a question or an issue or whatever. I didn't know, you know, I needed to escalate something. Who do I reach out to? They were always available to me. You know, so the bosses that I had, you know, that were micromanagers were just the worst. I had to, you know, my company went through some changes, and I was kind of a hot potato for a little while because they were restructuring things, and a couple of those managers that I ended up reporting to were those micromanager types, and one of them was the worst. I mean, he was just the worst, and really focused on the numbers, you know. It's like it wasn't the quality of your work, it was the quantity of your work. You know, all he cared about was the numbers, and, you know, and I'm just like, this is just ridiculous. You know, I was almost about ready to quit. And then, thankfully, we got a new chief information officer, and then we underwent again another restructuring, and ended up back with my original boss that was an awesome boss. And I was like, thank God, you know.
Yeah.
Thank God,
right.
My blood pressure can go back down to normal again.
What about you, Joe? Now, you've talked about your experiences as a boss and the workers who, you know, who are lazy, apathetic, try to get over on you. Now, either in the DEA, either in the government, or even in the private sector, what about either the colleagues or the bosses? Since Lorianne was talking about her experiences, I briefly gave thumbnail versions of mine. You know, what has come to mind to remind you of maybe your early days when you got out of high school and had to look for a job, or even, you know, way after that? Or the more memorable.
When I was in high school, when I was in high school, it's hard for me to really remember. I worked for a pizza place. I remember I was 14 years old, freshman in high school. I used to walk after school to a pizza place. I was a dishwasher and then a press cook. And I was working for an Italian guy that didn't speak English. So, you know, and that was rough, you know, because he couldn't speak English. So, and his wife worked as the head waitress, and those two would argue, and she always be in tears. that he just put her down. I mean, he would just tear her apart. And I'm like, what an asshole, you know? I mean,
right.
And that was my first experience as far as seeing how a husband or, you know, how a boss and a wife can't work together. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That reminds me when I was, 16, the year before I went into the service, I had a job as a mess boy up at camp. I went to camp during the summer. And after my camp experiences were over, you know, I was no longer a camper, I got a job as the mess boy, the mess attendant, and which was good because that showed that the people that hired you liked you. So I liked that, the fact that they picked me from the other people. And let me tell you, when you have that was my first job, but it was amongst my first. And when you have a job like that, where you actually are working from 9 to 5, whereas the year before, you were a camper, and it was a well-run camp, and I had fun, the contrast makes you realize, you know, some things that you've experienced, that you've taken for granted because you've done it for a number of years, because I was a camper for a number of years, and now you are in the real world. And you got to get your hands dirty, your knees dirty. You got to do a whole bunch of crap, and you got to do it right. And you got people, you know, who are, you got to please the bosses and stuff like that, as opposed to just enjoying softball and basketball and football and swimming. You know, it makes you realize that this is the adult life now. Even though I was only 16, but I don't, like I said, the bosses that I had worked for, which were idiots, yeah, I could talk about them for a little while, but I don't even dwell on that. I'm not talking about I'm talking about the arrogant ones. But the idiots were the ones that bothered me the most, because here they are, they're putting in money into your infrastructure. You've got it set up. You've got your desk. You've got your operations. You've got your trucks. You've got your employees. You've got them. You're branching out. And yet, yeah, we just don't do that here. Are you nuts?
They don't want to expand on ideas.
Yeah, you know. So I'm sorry to have cut you off, Joe. I'm sure you had some, you know, some post-high school experiences.
Very few, actually, because, you know, like I said, and then I've always worked for myself, really, since when I went into the military, and then, like, you know, all the other work I did. And then, you know, like I said, to this time now, I mean, I've given up the landscaping. I pretty much phased it out because I just got, and I started, you know, obviously went into public, you know, running for public office. But I did get a job working as a security officer part-time recently. And, you know, and I worked by myself third shift, you know, and I didn't have a boss. So, I mean, I had a guy I had to report to in the morning, but, you know, he was just a nice guy. He loved me, you know, because I know how to work. You know, I was a business owner. I know what it takes, I guess you could say, through experience now to make a boss happy, you know, unless they're just total real assholes. Then I just wouldn't work for them, you know. But for the most part, I can, you know, even the asshole, I could try to outsmart and make them, you know, do enough to make them happy to know that, you know, that it'd be stupid to get rid of me, you know.
Yeah, you got to show that you're valuable. By the way, Laurie, since we've been talking about, Joe's talking about being an entrepreneur, I was an entrepreneur for a very short time, way, way back, many years ago. Have you ever thought about being an entrepreneur? Because you could take your experience as a freelance, you know. Maybe you could work from Fiverr online. Or have you ever thought about that?
I've tinkered around with it a little bit. You know, I've done some... You know, back in the day, I kind of, before I was promoted at my previous job, and I worked in office, and I was in charge of, like, you know, PC support, provisioning. I got to be, like, one of the best people when it came to, like, replacing computers and backing up their data and, like, not, you know, missing stuff. And, like, literally, there would be people in other offices that would ship me their laptops because they wanted me to to be the one to back up all their data and get everything back installed, and they'd be up and running again. They would rather be without their computer for 3 or 4 days, so, you know, than have their own local tech do it because they've had problems with their local tech, right? And so this then led to people that would approach me with their personal computers. And so I'd make some money on the side when they needed work done on their personal home computers. And so, you know, I have thought about it. not really sure, you know, about it all because, you know, we don't want to get into politics, but, you know, if you go into business for yourself, you know, it's not a very friendly environment to do so in a lot of ways. And so that's kind of the one drawback there. But you know, I've done some work on the side.
Yeah, you can talk about the politics as it relates to your, your ambition to become a freelancer or your reasoning for not becoming a freelancer. You know, you can talk about it because it's in context with what we're talking about tonight.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, it's different when you are, you know, working for yourself. You know, the tax reporting is different, regulated. There's, you know, red tape that you need to get through, I know. You know, and I only know a little bit of it, but it, you know, what I do know is enough to kind of turn me off to it. But, you know, it doesn't, you know, and it's like, is that really what I want to do? You know, that's another thing too. Like, you know, if I were to go into business for myself, what do I really want to do? And that's kind of the big question. You know, if I'm going to make that effort, what am I passionate about enough to put that effort in and make a business out of it?
You know, I didn't want to talk about politics. Now. We've only got a few minutes left before we go into overtime. And since Joe is here, Joe, you talk about your experiences, you know, being a DEA agent. Sometimes you talk about it on different shows, but you only talk about it on a sporadic basis. So it's an intermittent type of thing. Until somebody else calls in or until Lorianne has a memory about a real asshole other than the other one that she worked for, and for her to chime in, why don't you tell people, we've got 25 minutes left, take your time, because I think people need to know about who you are and what the government did not do. What they were supposed to do, but they didn't do, what has happened to you, put it into context, because your show is about politics, and I think people need to know your background. So if you don't mind...
I don't mind when people ask me. Like I said, I always want to tell the truth, but where do you want me to start? I mean, it's just so much... It's so much information that could be, you know, and dive in.
I'll,
you know, it's hard to start.
All right. I know that you infiltrated a gang and you became president of that gang. How did you become a president of a Spanish gang?
Okay. That's a good question. Okay. Well, first of all, it's not a Spanish gang. The Latin Kings is a Latin gang. And if you're Italian, if you're Peruvian or from Argentina, Spain or Mexico or many, many different Latin countries. So, and being Italian is actually Latin. So the Latin Kings accepted the Italians and as members in where I was at. So how I became a member was, you know, that when they first told me, they said, we want you to join the Latin Kings. I was like, how the hell am I going to do that? You know, and they knew I had a friend that was the chief enforcer, which was the chief enforcer in charge of the security of the Latin Kings. This is a very militant gang, and they have a very structured hierarchy. You have a president, you have a vice president, you have a presidential counselor, you have a philosopher, you have a secretary, you have a treasurer, and you have a chief enforcer. You have seven clowns. That's what they call them, seven clown structure. And then you have a regional commander that's on the street that's called an RC. at the regional crown. Okay, that you know hands like does like the chapters of like an area, kind of like a county versus a town. You know, and then you've got the on the street, and you have your seven crowns that are in charge of the state chapter. And then you have the founder, which was Nelson Millett. He's doing life in Pontotoc, California or something. He might be dead now, I don't know. But he was the original founder. But anyway, they told me, we want you to join the Latin Kings. And then he said, we'll structure it. What they would do is they would ship out the hierarchy, move people in that I could work with from other prisons, you know, and it was softer guys. And the guys that were in holding the positions, they'd ship them out methodically so I could move up the ranks quickly. And then, of course, I had to perform a hit. And so they allowed me, which is actually against the law, they allowed me to assault another inmate. And they should not have done that, actually. But, and then we set up another assault, actually. They set that up where they moved the inmate out of the prison, and they made it look like I assaulted him. So I got my stripes like that, kind of, and like with my respect, you know what I mean?
Right.
So, I became a crown member. Actually, the first position that opened up was a presidential counselor. And obviously, I'm a good talker, and I'm not stupid. I have an education. I come from an educated background. A lot of these kids that were gang members don't, you know. So I became presidential counselor. Then they moved the VP out. I became VP, and then I became president of the gang. When I became president, they were so happy. They're like, wow, you know, they're all going to get promotions now. Everybody, you know, all the intelligence officers and everybody. And so that's how I became a member of the gang. But I even got a tattoo on my right shoulder of a crown, and that says ALKN, Almighty Latin King Nation. I have a tattoo. It's on my shoulder blade on my back. I've never got it removed since, but I've always thought about it, but. You know why? But again, I tell people the story. They don't believe me anyway. They don't believe the story. I got to point them to the book. I said, "There's a book written about it. There's transcripts in the book, court transcripts. How am I going to fake that?" You know, because when I told the story to people in the beginning, they didn't believe me. They thought I was full of crap. When I tell people now, they don't believe me. You weren't president of the Latin Kings. You're full of shit. You know, I got paperwork. Mm-hmm. I got that says it. You know, it doesn't matter anyway. What people believe, I know what I saw. I know what I did, and I know what I experienced. And I know when I sued the state of Connecticut and whatnot, and I know when the news it made national news media attention when the jury was so afraid that they begged out of the trial. That's actually on the back cover of the book, actually, that the front page story where the jury begged out of trial for fear of safety, which was a huge story in the state of the Northeast at that time, that's when things spun out of control for me, when that happened, when that trial happened, it was corruption there, the judge dismissed the case he wasn't supposed to. It was the first time in the history of the United States in all civil cases where a jury was let go because they were afraid. They give them protection. You can give them protection. Give them escorts. Give them armed escorts. Don't dismiss them during the trial because I was winning my case, so the attorney general was knowing that the next person that I was going to be testifying against was Richard Blumenthal. And then Senator Joe Lieberman, who was going to be president, or vice president, I mean, running with Al Gore, they didn't want me talking about him. So what are they going to do? We got to whack this guy, you know, and that's what happened. You know, I was told I was going to be killed. They were calling my house, telling me you're dead. A little birdie came and told me that, you know, somebody I was working with undercover, I don't want to say his name, he said, you know, you really should consider getting out of here, you know, because they got a contract out on you. And they gave a contract to a gang, actually, and to kill me. And I said, well, let them come. I'll be ready. So, you know, and they came, and that's when they stabbed me. You know, they actually tried to shoot me in the head, blow my head off with the gun jammed. And then that's when they stabbed me in the chest. And they put me in Yale New Haven Hospital for a week under an alias, actually. That's how protected I was after that. And then that's why I left the state of Connecticut and came down here to North Carolina. That was the deal that I made. I got screwed. It took me a long time to get the charges that they stacked on my record off my record. Because, you know, I was an inmate inside of a prison. I mean, you know, and so they had to stack extra charges.
I know. Oh,
I spent more than
2 years there.
Spent two years in segregation, in administrative segregation. You know, when I assaulted the inmate there, I had to stay in segregation because that's protocol for inmates when they stab an inmate. you have to stay in segregation. If I would have got out early of segregation, then I would have been liable to snitch. How'd you get out of segregation early? So I had to stay in another state of segregation to prove, you know, that who I was. So it's kind of like that movie Donnie Brasco. You know, the guy who worked undercover for 6 years with the mafia.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what I did. I worked for years undercover, and then that's like I said. Well, I don't know what else you want to know. Where else I can carry on with the story, but like I said, there's a book written about it. But the guy that wrote the book, he didn't do too good of a job. I think it should have been written better. It should have been made into a movie. That's what I've been told, because, you know, with the court transcripts, they really tell the story in detail, because the testimony, because they come in and they testify against me, the government, right? And they boldly lie so bad. Joe, they said, when I got my neck slashed open, right, the captain of the state police goes, when he got his neck slashed open, and my lawyer goes, well, there was a lot of, he lost a tremendous amount of blood, he almost died, he goes, I only saw one drop of blood. A 6.5-inch laceration, half inch deep on my neck. I only lost a drop of blood. That's what he said. What an arrogant son of a bitch! And he's smiling at me, smirking at me. Because they didn't like the fact that I sued him. You know, they failed to protect me. Hey, you didn't do your job, man. You don't do your job, you got to pay. You know. I mean, I didn't know what was going to happen to me afterwards. You know, I got my throat slashed open. To this day, I get severe headaches, stiff neck. I mean,
I wanted to talk to you about the trauma that you had of undergone being in lockup and being in being in the hole for 2 years. And
oh, God.
The thing is,
it was rough, though.
Yeah,
rough.
I mean, most people think, you know, you watch a movie and people probably think, you know what, I could do that standing on my head. I don't think a lot of people could actually stand on their head in real, as you call it, administrative segregation, in the hole where there's nothing but cockroaches, shit, guards who probably spit in the food, rats running around.
They arranged fights, too. They would arrange the gladiator games, they would call them. And what they would do is they'd put one inmate in the rec yard, which is not really a rec yard, it's a concrete birdcage. And they'd put, like, a rival gang member in there, and they'd let you fight it out. And, you know, and then, of course, they break it up when they shoot at you, a rubber bullet or something, you know. And because the guards were betting on it. Who would win? They were doing that inside the Supermax. You know, how about that? Let inmates fight.
I mean, you see it in the movies, you don't believe it, but, you're somebody who has experienced it and has had its toll on you. What I would be interested in, and what a lot of people would be interested in, I'm sure Lorianne would be as well, is how did these government scumbags, why and how did they betray you? Why would they do that? Why would they set you up?
I don't know. I don't know to this day, to be honest. I thought it came out in the trial, too, actually, that he was asked. He says, he looked up to you. You guys had a good working relationship. Why did you do that? Why did you let this happen to him? Why did you set him up? You know, and he basically said I was just another. He said at that time I viewed him as just another inmate in the prison system. He was like, I don't know why, Joe, to this day. I don't know. We tried to get into his head on the witness stand, he made an ass out of himself on the witness stand. I mean, he just totally made an ass out of himself. But it was just like my lawyer tried to break him down and to say, yeah, I screwed up. I screwed up. I was supposed to protect him. But we just couldn't break him, you know, to admit it, to openly admit it. But we found later on in their own reports and statements that they gave, in their own reports and statements, they openly admit that they tell the story that they made a mistake. They knew they had to get me out of undercover work because there was a contract put out on me, and they had to get me out of that prison. But they wanted me to finish working on a case against a prison guard that was bringing in large quantities of cocaine, and they wanted me to finish working that case first. But the contract was already down. My cover was blown. They put the Terminators, a faction of the Latin Kings, had owned the contract to kill me, and there was four Terminators in the prison. They moved out three, and they forgot one. Now, did they purposely forget the one? How could they? I just met with the gang intelligence coordinator 1 hour prior to them, the assault happening. I'm like, you got to move this guy out of here. He's coming to kill me, man. I said, otherwise, I got to do what I got to do. I got to take him out first. They, oh, don't do that. Don't do that. You know, we don't want to screw it up. We don't want to put you back in segregation. We don't have time for that. So we'll get him out of there. We'll get him out of there. Well, they move three of the guys out, and they forget one. So I'm like, okay, they forgot one, you know. So I go on the phone. I got a phone that has a direct line to the office of my handler, right? And I'm tied with a PIN number. I dial a special code, you know, into the phone and with the phone number, and it goes to the guy's office. So I pick up the phone, and I go to call, and I punch in the code. I lean forward to see the numbers on the phone. They had push-button phones, you know, like pay phones in there inside the prison. I leaned forward, and that's when the son of a bitch came behind me and slashed my throat open. You know, and if I didn't lean forward, he would have chopped my whole head off. Probably, and my jugular would have been severed, and I would have died, right? That would have bled out probably in a minute and a half. You know, the doctor said I literally came within an inch of my life. You know, that's what he said when your stake went up my neck. But why they turned on me, I don't
know.
I know
why. I know why. Because they got bought off. They got paid off.
Yeah.
What else? What other reason could there be? There had to be, you know, you were getting too close to somebody or would have gotten too close to somebody, and they didn't want you to find out who the, I mean, who that particular important person was, probably Joe Biden's son, something like that. Right?
By the way, we have 9 minutes left of the live broadcast, so if you're out there and you're listening and you want to go into overtime with us, now is the time to call in within the next 8.5 minutes or so now. 646-478-5284. Okay, back to you.
Thank you, Joe.
The day-to-day living in there was the most brutal because I lost my freedom. I was just another inmate in the system, basically. And to go through that trauma of being in there with, you know, with the inmates, it was hard because I had to become a criminal. I had to really be hardcore. I had to become violent. I mean, they put me in the most violent prisons in the Northeast. So, you know, and they're bouncing me around, transferring me. I mean, and then I end up in a riot in Carl Robinson and Enfield. I mean, it was crazy. 1,000 inmates in the rec yard killing each other. I'm like, oh, my God. I thought I was dead for sure. You know, so it was in 1994, actually, the Carl Robinson riot. 75 inmates went to the hospital, 2 dead, 3 dead, I think. I mean, it was just insane. It was just insane. It was like a scene from Braveheart when they're all fighting in the middle of the field. That's what it was like. You know, like Indians running around. So, but the day to day, the food that was just terrible in there. The treatment of the inmates. I could see why, you know, they abuse the inmates.
Sure.
There's no type of rehabilitation whatsoever. For people, I mean, and just think now, this is why you have the revolving door of the prisons, because, you know, really you can rehabilitate these guys. A lot of these guys want to do good, but they have no hope. You know, I mean, what can they do? Well, they got strikes against them. They're felons. You're not going to get a job anywhere. You know, you're going back to the city where the gangs are. You're a gang member. What are you going to do? You know, you got to roll with your crew or your clique, you know, or you're dead, you know, so that's all, you know, what can you do? You know, you got to survive. It's the jungle. That's what it is. It's the laws of the jungle. It's sad. And the system sets it up that way. The system has designed it that way.
I agree with you. The system does set it up that way so that there is recidivism, so that these people, when they get in there and then when they get out, they don't have hope. What are they going to do? Where are the real counselors, instead of defunding the police? What about putting social workers on, you know, and hiring social workers, hiring true therapists to talk with these people, make them realize that they do have a life outside of prison, outside of gangs, they can make it on their own, and that they don't have to be defined by their past.
I guess I'm a testimony of that, right? I mean, technically, right? Even though I was working undercover, I still was in there, and you can still get out and do good. You know, I've seen guys do it. You know, I guess you could say, actually, I didn't get no help when I got out, that's for sure. I mean, the government didn't want nothing to do with me anymore. That's why I sued them. But, I mean, I just don't know what the quick fix is to that type of problem, Joe. I think counseling is a good idea because people have to have jobs. They have to have opportunity. If there's no opportunity to make money, what do? You hustle.
Right. Let me interrupt because somebody, well, they haven't raised a hand yet, but 360, I see you. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, but what do? I mean, you know, you figure, if just put yourself in that position. Say you're a 20-year-old kid, you got a bunch of felonies now on your record, you get out of prison tomorrow. Where are you going to go? Back home with your mom, your dad. What happens if you've got no family? You know, you probably got a girlfriend or something. You know, you're going back to the city streets. What are you going to do? You're going to hook back up with your clique, your crew, and you're going to sell drugs, or you're going to hustle, rob, steal, cheat. I mean, where's the hope? There's no hope.
Right, because even for people who haven't been to jail, right, like Lorianne and myself at times and most people, trying to find a job, even though I've got six letters of recommendation. I've had people, like I said, I was fired, what was it, eight times? I think it was eight times, and five of them wanted me back. But, and that's without having a criminal record. So you're right. If you've got a criminal record, right, people are going to look at you and say, oh, shit, I don't want him around at all. So, and we have our favorite instigator here. Okay. This is how you're going to handle this. Come on. Come up. Here we go.
I do have something to comment on, too, eventually. But, go ahead.
All right. Warren, you're on. You know that you've been unmuted. So what you got?
Oh, am I on?
You're on.
Yeah, I was listening to Joe, and, I mean, I agree with what he said about the prison. He sounds like what people would call a bleeding heart liberal. And this is one of the platforms, prison reform and opportunities for inmates. This is, you hear this being spoken about on the liberal side. On the right, it's about locking people up and, getting hard on criminals. But that issue that Joe talks about is very real. He speaks from experience. And when you look at the war on drugs that was initiated, and you had the distinction in crack cocaine and pure powder cocaine and the disparity in sentencing, and the crack cocaine was being distributed in heavily black neighborhoods, then you had a whole lot of black guys locked up because of that crack. And so that's the issue that you have, people being in jail with conviction rates and all that. So it's just interesting to hear Joe articulate that, but that is not something conservative Republicans say or sympathize with. That's what I find interesting.
Okay. Well, you may not know. You probably came in and heard Joe talk, and that probably piqued your interest for you to call in. But the thrust of the show tonight is about bad bosses, bad colleagues. What are your stories for when you were working with bad bosses and or bad colleagues? Any memorable moments that you'd like to either forget or remember for the rest of your life?
No, I went to work. When I was working, I'm retired now. I did my job, no nonsense. And if I felt that I had problems, I would immediately put it in writing, immediately. I didn't let nothing linger around because I was ready to sue. I was ready to confront anything that I felt that I was being harassed. And it didn't kind of mess with me on the job.
Well, outside of the harassment, I mean, any bosses who were just playing as on a personal basis because of their personalities, that they were assholes. And Lorianne, you can jump in anytime in about 2 minutes after Warren gets finished, because I know you wanted something to say, but I wanted to give Warren a chance to express himself before you jumped in. So go ahead, Warren. Any any bad colleagues, bad bosses who are just on a personal level, not because they were harassing you, but they may have been, but because they had bad policies or because of their personalities or because of micromanagement, et cetera, anything like that?
Well, I worked in the oil and gas industry here in Louisiana. I worked for oil companies. I did that for a few decades, and I retired. And you had bad employees. You had people who really didn't know their job, and then you had to be the one to cover for them and to help out. You have, I've seen employees come in with problems, and the supervisors would give them a pass. They may have had substance abuse problems, family problems, so on and so forth. But I didn't, supervisors and bosses didn't play with me because I didn't tolerate that. That was the type of environment I was in, making sure that I'm not, because I was kind of working in a good old boy type of environment too. So I was ready to go to battle if I felt anybody was coming at me the wrong way.
Okay. So, all right. So, I guess you just don't have bad bosses to work for, or to
remember. You had bosses that were buttholes, but I made sure they wasn't a butthole with me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how did they know that you were going to write them up? Did you let them know the first day, or how did you let them know?
What I would do, I had a habit of communicating in writing if I felt something didn't smell right, and they were afraid of the writing. They were afraid of responding to you in email when you presented a concern to them, because they know whatever they say would be a document, would be a record. And I tell people this all the time on the jobs. Do not go in those offices and always talk. Always air out the issue in writing. And always have a question in the email. Don't accuse the supervisors of anything. You ask questions. In fact, one situation, I even made these comments in the email. Could you have someone investigate whether or not my constitutional rights are being violated? And you see that kind of talking in email? Well, they back off. They back off of you. See, I know how to write. I didn't go in offices and talk and get into arguments, because then it's he say, she say in a meeting with two people.
I can also attest to that. I remember when I was doing training with the government, when you're a person over 55, they had these training programs, and I got into one of the training programs, and I got into a situation with a couple of people. And as a result, they had threatened to release me from the program. So I had actually written an email and a letter to the supervisor. And it wasn't threatening. It was just laying down the facts, but letting them know that I wasn't satisfied. And as a result, they had, I got some reconciliation as a result of that. So, yeah, I can attest to writing. I guess it was on the similar type of basis, you know. And yeah,
Joe, I'm laughing at something. Yeah. Brandon Boy put in the chat room. Why are you not in prison? You want to be a crack whore like you?
Who's writing that?
Brandon Boy put that in the chat room.
Oh, Resident Bob.
Bringing it boy.
Oh, Bring It Boy. Wrote that about who?
About me.
Oh, about you. Oh. How
yeah,
come
why
you're
not in prison?
Feel the love. Feel the love.
Yeah. All right, so now we're in overtime. Okay. So, Lorianne, what was it that you wanted to say?
Back when Warren first came on and we were talking about, you know, the prison reforms and kind of the, you know, the stuckness of, you know, when people get released and nobody wants to hire them and all that kind of stuff, it reminded me of one of my favorite TV shows is Pit Bulls and Parolees on Animal Planet. As a matter of fact, it's my dog Nikita's favorite show. She learned how to shake by watching one of those shows. But anyway. They rescue dogs and they deliberately hire people that are on parole. I really love that concept because it's like you said, there's a lot of people that really do want to get out of the life that got them in prison to begin with. And, what a great avenue to do that is, you know, to help an animal rescue organization, to help dogs. You know, and bring them in and care for them and things like that. It's I loved that concept, and that's why it became one of my favorite shows, for that very reason. And I think that there should be a lot more of that kind of a thing, because, you know, when you have somebody that, you know, that really has the odds stacked against them when it comes to finding a job, you know, you can get some really good people, you know, that will help your organization, you know, and you give them a life, you give them a decent wage, you know, get them a leg up in this world, and hopefully, you know, they end up being productive. You know, some of those parolees end up, you know, resorting back to their old habits, but a lot of them end up, you know, leaving station because they have a better job offer. Now they have their, you know, they discovered a different passion along the way. They just go in a different direction career-wise and end up coming back. Like sometimes they'll have like follow-up segments on, you know, happened to so-and-so. And, you know, so-and-so is now, you know, married, has kids, has a good job, was able to get a house, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's like, I love seeing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and this is something that Americans should be very concerned about. Because if we're going to pack into these non-rehabilitation centers, actually into these warehouses, a bunch of people who either because of the three-strike law or because of a strict judge or because of a good prosecuting attorney convincing the jury that somebody deserves to go to prison for 5, 10, 15 years, when they get out, it becomes our problem. They are the people who are going to move in down the street if they can get that apartment. They are the people, if they get a job, will be working next to you. They have mental issues, and they should have mental issues, especially those who have been convicted when they're innocent, and they've spent time in jail amongst people who now have a burning hot desire to kill other people inside prison. They feel life isn't worth living unless they're killing somebody. They've gone over the edge because what has happened to them has traumatized them so much that they've now become psychotics. So
well,
as a result,
institutionalized. They call that institutionalized. That means you're happy with your environment and you like it in there and you're not going nowhere. You know, you're comfortable. So You become the most violent guy in the system that you could possibly be. You know, I've seen those guys and it happens, you know. I mean, dangerous people in there. Some people turn into that type of person.
Yeah, and if they get out, as they're saying, maybe if they're too comfortable being in the prison, they don't want to get out. Maybe now they're a small fish in a small pond, and they like it. But for those who do get out, who wanted to say something?
No, Joe Montana, I'm going to look at that documentary you mentioned called White Boy. I was reading about it, and I look at it. If it's still on Netflix, I'm going to go try to find it because it looks like it's something interesting. I had never heard of that before, that situation.
If you can't find it on Netflix, then go to Tubi, T-U-B-I, TubiTV.com. And it's a free streaming service. And just put in the search engine, White Boy. And what it is, it practically mimics what happened to Joe, except that Joe is a DEA agent. This is a poor 17-year-old kid that they try to make the public believe that he was the head of a gang, the head of a drug cartel, and he got sent to prison. He was supposed to be getting paroled or getting parole hearings once every 5 years. He only got them once in 28 years. He was sentenced when he was 17. It was a constitutional issue, but the mayor of Detroit was mixed up with drugs. So they wanted to make sure that this kid wasn't going to come out and ruin things. So the kid had two lawyers affiliated with Coleman, who was the mayor of Detroit, that saw to it that this kid would get convicted, not acquitted, but convicted, so that he would go to jail and not be a threat. And he eventually got out after 28 years because there was a female judge that had taken a look at the case, and they said, no, this kid, because of his age alone, he went to jail, which violated the Constitution. It was a constitutional matter. So that was a matter of politicians betraying a kid who, now, who was it? Not the, it was the police. It wasn't the DEA. At the age of 14, they had this kid as a lookout to find drugs, as an informant, to find drug dealers and report them, rat on them, to his handler, okay, at the age of 14. And then at the age of 17, like I said, the propaganda from mainstream media, probably influenced by the politicians, were trying to make this white boy in Detroit, where it was all populated by blacks and Hispanics, especially the drug trade, they're trying to make him out to be a kingpin.
But when you look at the crack distribution, that was also, according to some informants, put into the communities by the government. When the United States was trying to fund the Contras against the Sandinistas, it sold drugs in the community. In fact, one of the black guys who actually was one of the big drug dealers when this first came out,
His name was Rick Ross.
Gary Webb, a reporter for one of those papers in San Francisco, a white guy, wrote a book about it, and he got fired from the first the newspaper ran his investigative articles, and then I guess when the FBI and the CIA got on the paper and all that, they retracted it, all of it, and this guy winds up committing suicide. Gary Webb, that was the journalist that broke that story. And I forget, the California newspaper ran a series of his articles about the government's involvement with the distribution of crack and so on and so forth. And then the FBI and feds, what I'm saying, gets on the paper, then retracts the story. He loses his job, he's isolated, and next thing you know is supposedly he committed suicide.
I doubt if he committed suicide. If it's the same Gary Webb that I'm thinking of, probably a setup. But, yeah, I mean, look, we could talk all day about government betrayal, because we have a government here, regardless of whether you're a liberal or a conservative or a libertarian. We have to realize that the government is corrupt as hell, and it's because they receive too much money for them to remain honest, if they were honest to begin with, when they got elected or appointed to their position. So that's that would be an interesting show for somebody. Me, I'm not inclined to put on political shows anymore. I'm not inclined to go to political shows anymore. So
you're not inclined. Wait, whoa. You're not inclined to go to political shows no more. How come?
Well, that's because number one, we were supposed to have a continuation of the BTR coalition that fell apart. So I wanted to talk to you about that and other things in private. Like I said, when you have the time, you can give me a call and we can talk. And we have somebody else on the line hasn't raised a hand yet. But
you got my number,
okay.
Joe. I don't have your number, Joe. You got my number, so write it down if you see my number and call me.
All right. I thought you had my number. You called me one time. Okay.
Did I?
You gave me a call one time.
Let me say this about the work topic. One of the issues you see with a lot of young people on jobs is they are talking back to their bosses and their supervisors on these jobs. In fact, I saw a Twitter video. A kid was in Home Depot, and a customer, he got into it with a customer, then he threatened to fight the customer. They had to ask him to leave.
Really?
So you have a lot of young people don't have the discipline and the mannerisms to follow instructions on the job or to have courtesy, and that is becoming a problem all across the United States.
Oh, yeah, it's bad. I agree with that. That's real bad. especially fast food places. Terrible. Service is terrible. They always screw up the order. I never even go anymore. Just for that. Mm. You order more than one thing, they screw up the order.
Well,
but pay them
the
more. Pay them more for the most simple jobs that they can't manage to do correctly. Don't you love it?
Well, and where is that, Joe? That's in South Carolina. The Waffle House workers are going on strike. I think that's in South, one of those cities in South Carolina. The Waffle House workers are starting to strike. Because they go through so much working for the low wages, with customers coming in early hours of the morning, late at night, wanting to fight and all that kind of stuff. They have had enough of that.
Well, I think it probably stems from lack of parental training, because if you're going to train your kid to be responsible, then you're going to carry that over not only into school, but when you get your first jobs, your second jobs, et cetera, you're going to become a person who believes in responsibility. And I believe that a manager should be listened to, should be obeyed, as long as the manager treats a person that they're whoever's under his supervision fairly. And I also believe that the employees have a right to not to talk back, but to make suggestions in a proper way to let the supervisor know that perhaps, you know what, supervisor, I think what you've done could be done a little bit better. I'm not talking about policies or the operations, but the way that the supervisor is treating people. That particular person may have an ego that's a little bit too thin, and that particular person has to be let known, has to know, that he can't go around bossing people, because if he does, or micromanaging people in the wrong way, eventually he's going to come across Billy Badass. Billy Badass isn't just going to talk. He's going to punch him out. So just out of a sense of self-preservation, you know, learn how to control yourself, your ego, so that you can talk to people in a way to let them know, I'm the boss, like me, I'm the boss. I expect people to follow my suggestions, my recommendations, my commands, whatever you want to call them, my orders. But if I'm going to tell you to do something, I should do it in a way that makes you feel as though I'm not putting you down, but you still have to do what I say. But if a person doesn't know how to do that, if they resent the fact that there are people telling them what to do, I mean, I blame the parents. I guess I could blame the schools, but I would blame private schools for that. I wouldn't blame public schools so much. Public schools, they're just nothing more than just institutions themselves. What is it that somebody once called them? Minor incarceration centers, you know, when you're going to school because you're chained up to a desk.
I like that.
Yeah, and you've got teachers who don't give a rat's ass whether you learn or not, right? So here you are, and you're from the age of 5 through the age of 16, having to go to school, sit at a desk, can't move around. And if you do move around, you're in a classroom where there's a bunch of other schmucks who are disrupting the educational process. So America, we got to straighten ourselves out, you know, got to straighten ourselves out. And Lori Ann. Since we're in overtime, we have another person on the line. He hasn't raised his hand. Is it possible for that person to be cut off, or should I just put him on and then tell him to mute himself? Would that be safer for him?
Yeah, before our overtime ends, you know, if we go into a third hour, then usually I unmute on our end before the switchboard, but we should be okay for another 40 minutes?
45 minutes or something. Okay. All right. I won't be on at the end. If you want to handle it at the 11 o'clock hour, that's fine, because I'm getting off then. Two to three hours is enough for me. Even if it is my own show, that's enough.
Yeah, I started yesterday at 7 o'clock. It didn't get off until 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, geez. Oh,
wow.
So the political aspect with regards to how it's how it becomes part of the secular and the private sector is an interesting part in some instances. And, I didn't want to talk about politics tonight, but, I think Joe's story needed to be told. You told it before. I wanted to give you at least 25 minutes uninterrupted time so that you could tell it the best way that you felt that it should be told. Because I personally believe that for you to have been betrayed by the government, for you to have – you didn't even talk about when you were when you were being four-pointed. When you were being, when you were being tortured by Americans, you're practically, you're in a black site practically, where they just ship you off to Gitmo. As a matter of fact, the prisoners in Gitmo probably get better treatment than the max prisons here in America. So it's a story that needs to be told because we can see it as a made-for-TV movie, but I think, when somebody undergoes that kind of experience, it should resonate with Americans that, this is the land of the free, home of the brave, sometimes. Other times, it's the land of betrayal, and Americans have been betrayed. So, people need to wake up to that fact.
What is the Supreme Court? Is that true? The Supreme Court is trying to eliminate the bail or something? I saw a story about that.
Are they
trying to eliminate bail? Yeah, that's what
I
heard.
I know. They can't do that. It's part of the Constitution, I believe. Well, we'll see. We don't know. We're becoming a dictatorship slowly but surely anyway. So who knows what the Supreme Court can do? It doesn't matter because the way our brains are have been propagandized and we're such in the matrix, it's they can tell us a man is a woman and a woman is a man, and people are starting to believe it. So people will believe anything. They will believe anything. And they're trying to rewrite history. They're trying to make history books now, from what I understand, start from like 1860 as opposed to when the pyramids landed on Plymouth Rock. They're trying to eliminate the history of the slavery and maybe of the extinction of the Indians. So, they're trying to reshape our minds, particularly those of the younger children, the younger kids, so that they can become very good drones. It's war of the world. This is 1984, which has been predicted by Orwell and talked about by Huxley. We're in it, So, if we don't truly wake up and actually take action, well, we're just going to go by the wayside. So,
now,
having
Joe,
said that.
I just want to say, Joe, this is an article from the Chicago Times. It's the Illinois State Supreme Court. It says Illinois is set to be the first state to end cash bail after state Supreme Court ruling. Landmark criminal justice reform isn't unconstitutional, should take effect in September. In other words, there were conservative justices were trying to – conservative people were trying to – they were against criminal justice reform. So this thing with the bail was used as a way to kind of keep people in jail. They don't have the certain amount of money they have to get out of bail. So Illinois is going to end cash bail is what this is about. So this is part of what they call criminal justice reform. And
what's that mean? Anything you get arrested for, then you go to jail automatically? You can't post bond?
I'm gonna have to see how that. But this is supposed to. It says Illinois is set to become the first state in the nation to eliminate cash bail after the state Supreme Court ruled Tuesday that a landmark criminal justice reform law did not violate the state's constitution. So you see that everything you were saying about what has to change with criminal justice, this Supreme Court decision upholds criminal justice reform, because apparently there were, I suspect there were conservatives, was trying to say that this would violate the Constitution. It says, while other states have implemented similar reforms with varying degrees of success, Illinois would be the only one to completely do away with having to pay money to get released from jail. And then they go on and on about that. So, I mean, you have to read more to find out what that means when you get arrested in Illinois. I'm sure they're going to have some sort of way you be able to get out. The court's only two Republican justices dissented, saying, quote, the legislature's abolishment of monetary bail is in direct violation of the plain language of our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and more specifically, the vested rights of crime victims. This court has an absolute obligation to declare. So you see where the conservatives are against aspects of criminal justice reform, but the Supreme Court upheld the end of bail cash for Illinois. So, see everything you were saying in terms of what needs to change in the prison don't line up on the side of the room the Republicans are advocating.
Well, that's nice, except that I'm not going to talk about it because this is the show about, bosses and neighbors, bosses and colleagues. And you can bring it up on your show or Joe's show or Laurie Ann's show, but this show, I haven't read the article. When I do, and if I ever find the need to go back on another chit-chat show and talk about it, then I will. But right now, I'm not addressing it. Mm. But if anybody here, anybody else wants to, you can jump on in. I guess not. Okay.
Well, let me say something about jobs and bosses. Also on these jobs, women have had to fight off sexual harassment, not only by their boss and supervisors, but from many of the other guys around on the job. That's still a big problem, and women shouldn't have to go to work to have to hear all type of dirty jokes, sexually suggestive messages, because the guys expect them to be easy on the job. That has to be torturous for a woman to go through something like that.
I would imagine it would be, and I would think that the mainstream media has propagandized that, too, and exaggerated things way out of proportion. We have a woman on the line now named Laurie Ann. If she wants to talk about any particular experiences with guys who were, she felt were out of line, she may. I happen to think that most guys, especially in the past 10 to 15 years, have learned to quiet down on the job. You can't even compliment a woman about her shoes without being reported to HR. So, Warren, if you can give me statistics about how many guys are harassing women, how many women are reporting the harassments, and how many of those reported harassments are true, I'd be glad to talk about it because that's part of the topic tonight about bad bosses, bad colleagues. So if you have that,
I don't have the statistics. I just hear from women. Yeah, I just hear from women who still work. I know when I was working, I stayed away from that, and I wasn't particularly white women. I kind of stayed away from white women. I didn't joke with them or nothing because I didn't want no kind of allegations against me. So I definitely was very cognizant of what you said on the job, and I didn't even do any compliments on things or something. Now, if I had gone to a bar and I saw one of the women at work after hours that, may not have been in my department, I might have gotten friendly at a bar. But for the most part on the job, I knew that would be something they would be looking at me to try to get me on. But unfortunately, that's still a big deal on these jobs.
Well, again, statistics are right. You don't have them at your fingertips.
No,
but again,
I don't have them at my fingertips. Because then you can't measure that because you have a lot of people going to not be interviewed and asked about their situations on these jobs.
Maybe yes, maybe no, but there are statistics that are garnered from human resource departments. Whether or not they're true, who knows? But again, from my experience, from when you talk to other people, other men, the kind of experiences that they go through, that they just compliment, touch a woman on the shoulder, compliment a woman on her shoes. If she likes the guy, it's not a problem. If she doesn't like the guy, all of a sudden it's harassment. So, you know what? That would be a good show to have people, guys and gals, talk about their particular experiences and see what they say when both genders are on the show together. That would be good. Laurie-Ann, you probably won't do it because you're mainly political. I don't think you would have that on your show. Joe, you probably wouldn't have it on your show. And Warren, you probably, I don't know if you would have it on your show or not because you're so wrapped up with conservative versus liberal. You know.
Yeah, when I finish my series of debunking conservative talking points, I'll probably get to that. But let me say this. I know when I go into restaurants like the I don't know if y'all are familiar with Golden Corral. If y'all have Golden Corrals where y'all live, it's a chain of restaurants where you go in. Yeah, all you can eat is an all you can eat type thing. And I noticed the waitresses have this tendency, and they're trying to be polite. Okay, baby. Okay, what you need, baby? Okay, honey. Okay, hun. Now, I'm not. In fact, when the last time I went to Golden Corral, and this young lady was saying that, I said to myself, some guy probably could make an issue out of this if they choose to do so. I mean, I wouldn't do it because I know she's being nice, and that's part of her cordiality and being friendly to customers. But then some guy could make an issue that, you know, hey, she's calling me baby and honey, and I don't feel comfortable with that. So I was saying to myself, I wonder if they may need to retrain these waitresses about not – using baby and honey so much, you know, then suppose some guy mistake that as a come on by the girl, and then he's standing outside till she gets off to harass her. So things have changed, the way people interact with each other. We recognize we can't do all like we used to do. So when we look at stuff like Alice, the television series Alice with Flo, and the way Flo was friendly with the customers, well, we know you ain't really supposed to be doing it in establishments like that today, nowadays.
Well, you know what I say to that? Eat my grits.
I was just thinking the same thing about Alice and Flo, you know, and she clearly did it, you know, because that got her better tips, you know. And then it's also, I think, it's a kind of a cultural thing too. You know, people in Minnesota don't talk that way, you know? So it kind of, it's pretty dominant, I think, mostly in the South for people to speak that way more so than people like in the Midwest where I'm from and stuff. So that's another part of it too. I know for me, you know, back when I worked in the office as the computer person, you know, and this was when, you know, I was a lot thinner and stuff, you know. I was kind of known as the hot IT chick. And I know that a lot of the, you know, salespeople, when they brought clients in to the conference room, I knew that they deliberately would bring me into the conference room for some kind of problem, like with the video projector, something I absolutely knew they knew how to work and operate. But they would bring me in because I was the hot IT chick, you know, to come and fix the problem with the video and, you know, that kind of thing. And I just went with the flow. I didn't really make a big deal out of it. I was like, you know, whatever, or so be it. And, but, you know, it's just, it was one of those things where, you know, you just kind of get used to some of those things. You know, it's like, you know, well, I guess, you know, so long as they're not pinching my ass, you know, denying me a promotion because I'm a woman, then, you know, I just kind of let it roll off my shoulders.
Well, something like that. I mean, if they're bringing you in just because you're eye candy and not saying anything to you and looking at you, I don't think a woman should be overly offended by that. And I don't think a woman should be overly offended by women, by men who look at them and smile and maybe not say anything as they walk down the hallway past each other. But I don't think women should be offended when the man compliments them, even if they don't know the guy that well. I remember when I was growing up, the water cooler was supposed to be the places where you met your future husband, your future wife, you know, or definitely your, you know, your girlfriend or your boyfriend. But now You can't talk to a woman. You can't talk to a woman in the workplace, because if she wants to make trouble, she'll find a way to make trouble. So if you don't say good morning, you're going to be on somebody's shit list. If you do say good morning, you're going to be on somebody's shit list, unless you're the kind of guy that makes it be known. You know, if you don't like my attitude around here, fuck you. As long as I'm polite, responsible, do my job, and, you know, and I'm friendly with you and you're friendly with me without it going too far, you know, don't fuck with me. So
well,
I think that's...
No, I still see stories that pop up in the news of women who have had to file lawsuits against their boss or supervisor because they demanded that they sleep with them in order to keep their job and get a promotion. That's still prevalent. That is still going on. And remember, a lot of these unskilled jobs, particularly these unskilled jobs, women working for the water board or working as truck drivers and all that, they're experiencing this kind of thing. Now, I'll tell you who I feel sorry for. I really feel sorry for young gay people, young gay, particularly transsexuals. I feel sorry for them because they are discriminated with in terms of getting employed at different places. And unfortunately, they have to resort to the sex, you know, selling their bodies to get some kind of money because people, now the Barnes, I don't know about the Barnes & Noble where you guys live, but the Barnes & Noble here, I've observed that quite a few of the employees are gay, both the women and the men. And I thought about it one day. I was in there and I saw this big, tall, I guess a transsexual. And I said to myself, standing in line to get my little white chocolate mocha, and I said to myself, well, I guess they have to have somewhere to work too, because it's probably hard for them to go work in other places. Now, not gay people in general. You have a lot of gay people that work jobs. I'm talking about the ones who, like, transsexual types, where it's a big 6-foot-tall guy with hair on his face with a wig on and lipstick, you know. And I kind of feel, and then the young people who are like this too, I really feel sorry for them because they're going through a lot. So although I don't necessarily endorse a lot of the lifestyle and things like that, they still have to work too, and they still have to make a living. And so I'm sure from what I read and heard from some of them, they face a lot of discrimination by not getting hired on a lot of these jobs.
Well, if they do, then I'm sure that they're, you know, these organizations, pride organizations they can go to, and the government especially they can go to nowadays, that can help them with their, you know, their particular complaints. But if somebody's 6 foot, has a beard, and wants to be called ma'am, like that video that came out a couple of years ago, come on, give me a fucking break, please. You know?
No, I wouldn't let my little granddaughter go in the bathroom when I see them go in the bathroom. I just wouldn't feel comfortable with my little granddaughter going in the bathroom if those transsexuals choose to go in the female bathroom. So I don't know if they do, because I have never seen them do that. I don't know if you have. You all seen the transsexual guys go in the female bathroom so far in public places?
Well, I haven't seen them, but I'm sure the mainstream media, again, has taken, molehills and made mountains out of them. Not that the transsexuals don't have a hard time, but, if you're 6 feet tall and you look like a guy and you look like an ugly guy and you have a voice that's deeper than mine and you want to be called ma'am, and you want to have laws. Do you know that in New York, that they want to make it a crime if you misgender somebody? So if you say yes, sir, to a guy who says that he is a transsexual, that, and that's not just a misdemeanor. I think they want to make that a felony. Come on, that's bullshit.
I would have to look that up. Now, what about Donald Trump as a boss and how he used his power and authority to mishandle people, according to what eyewitnesses have come forward and said?
Well, if I have Trump on the show, then I'll ask him.
Well, I think there's enough interviews he's given that you can kind of glean from what's been going on.
Well, you want to bring in Trump and want to bring in politics again. Again, I'm not going to address.
We're talking about work. We're talking about work, and that's a perfect example of looking at bosses. After all, he had that television series where he said you're fired. That's a perfect example of looking at bosses. What was the title of this show? It was called
The Apprentice, I think.
Right. But this show is called Bad Bosses, Bad Coworkers. And I think that looking at persons of the stature and wealth of him, I'm sure that they use their influence to really violate people all the time. I'm almost certain of that. I think that's very well documented. I'm sure
they do. But I want to hear from people and their personal experiences, and I don't give a fuck about Trump right now.
Yeah,
so
but
we're not talking
about
it. I am not talking about it, Warren. I'm talking about personal experiences. Got capiche? Anybody else with their personal experiences?
Well, yeah, I mean, I know that for me, you know, continuing the conversation as, you know, a woman in the workplace, especially, you know, back when I first, you know, started my previous job, that was, you know, what, 16 plus years ago now, you know, there still wasn't a whole lot of women in IT, you know, it's still kind of a boys club. And I know for me, one of my biggest peeves was when a coworker, you know, especially it always was a male coworker. Never once did I have a female coworker do this. It's taking credit for my ideas and my work. That has happened more than once. It got to the point one time where, you know, it was, like I said, where I had the one boss that was a micromanager. Well, he was also a boys club person, and one of my coworkers reached out to me for help to help solve a problem that somebody was having with their computers. He couldn't figure it out, and so I got looped into it, and I did the research, and then, you know, I replicated the issue and then figured out how to fix it. Told him how to fix it. Okay, you know, instruct the person to, you know, do this, click that, go here, you know. And so, you know, that guy goes back to the customer, sure enough. And the customer was a happy camper and everything. And then the next, you know, the next time we had our weekly phone call with the team, our boss gives him credit for solving that problem. Even though that boss was looped in with emails, I made sure when I sent an email with the instructions to my coworker and I CC'd my boss at the time, so he knew full well who figured it out, gave my coworker credit for it. And I was like, you know, fuck you.
Yeah, I don't blame you. That would rile the fuck out of me,
and
sure.
And the coworker didn't say, well, Lorianne helped me. My coworker, the male coworker, didn't even speak up and say, yeah, you know, Lorianne was a big help. She helped, you know, figure it out. He didn't even stand up for me. And I'm like, fuck you with your boys club. You know, that's another one of those reasons why I was so glad when I went back to my original boss. That wasn't like that. You know, and then, of course, my original boss went back to. I was so fuming that, you know, I actually reached out to him, you know, and forwarded him the email and, you know, told him to listen to the conference call because, of course, we always recorded our conference calls. And I'm like, look at this shit, you know.
Now that
I mean,
pissed me off.
What do you do? And then if I say something, you know, if I would have said something in that conference call, then I look like a bitch, you know, in front of the whole team. So it's like, if I do, damned if I don't kind of a thing.
Well, that was, like I was saying, that would definitely piss me off. I mean, if somebody's working in order to help the company, try to fix the bottom line or in the particular department that they're in to try to make progress, and somebody else just comes along to take credit willy-nilly for it. I mean, that's thievery as far as I'm concerned.
But, Joe, that's the kind of climate women have been living under a patriarchal society. The women weren't getting matter. And, unfortunately, there's been some progress. A lot of women still live under this type of attitude in conjunction with men. That's why I'm for rights of women. That's why I find it so hard women would side with ideological views that seek to keep them in an old role of being barefoot and pregnant.
Well, then, you know, they have to speak up and fight their way out of it. There are women, I'm sure, who are still oppressed today as a result of being in, you know, in positions that they feel that they're getting the short end of the stick, and I'm sure that a lot of it is true and a lot of it isn't. So this idea where women are still oppressed today in the workplace, I got to see more facts on that. Because I know, having worked in the workplace a while back, that men were very reluctant to do anything that would piss off women, because women would be running to human resources on a moment's notice. So there are people who, of course, will take advantage of a woman, just like there are women who will take advantage of a man in the workplace as well. So I'd like to actually have women and men, especially if they worked on the same job, to be on the show talking about their experiences. But I don't think that'll ever happen. I don't know anybody like that I can bring on. Maybe somebody else here. Joe, are you still there? I think Joe's still there. Right?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. So,
I remember as a kid when women had to go to their husband to buy stuff because women were not given credit. I remember that very well. They had to get the consent of their husband many times to get stuff on credit. So, in these jobs, you know, male bosses could be, and male coworkers could be, you know, real dickheads here, because I've seen it. Women, you know, I feel sorry for them a lot of times because they try to show that they're very competent and do their best, but they're in these environments where men tell jokes, dirty jokes, passing out pornography. And I remember back at the time when the VHS cassettes was out and the guys would be coming to work passing out this, hey, man, watch this, go watch this. And it was horrible. It was just horrible because I witnessed this kind of stuff. I ain't never participated in any disrespect towards women, because I knew that it gets in trouble, particularly a black guy on the job. So I did everything right. I didn't want to get caught up in that. But I saw guys do all that kind of stuff, you know, and I would feel sorry for the females because their humanity was disrespected, and they had daddies, they had brothers, they had sons and uncles who, if they had known that their daughter or sister or whatever was good, they'd have came there and killed some of them guys.
Well, today's environment is a lot different than it was back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I'm sure that there are instances in which women feel oppressed again in the workplace. but I don't think it's as prevalent as liberals would like to make it out to be, because that's their talking point. But again, in terms of personal experiences, that's what this show's about tonight. The ideologies of liberals versus conservatives about women or men and the inequality in the workplace, that can be for another time. But,
yeah, but that comes up. That comes up when we talked about bosses and coworkers. That naturally comes up because somebody might feel that, oh, well, there's nothing wrong with that, what that guy did. You're just a snowflake. Somebody might say something like that. And then somebody might say, well, that's not right. And then what happens is it starts falling within that ideological spectrum. Oh, you say that because you're this. That's just how it is nowadays. Well, you can't escape that. See,
I think it's as prevalent now. You know, I don't think it's as prevalent, but I think it's also become a lot more subtle. You know, people are a lot more careful about it, so that, you know, you can't run to HR with evidence. You know, so they're just more subtle and careful about it. You know, it really was like, you know, I talk about the boys club, you know, at my job. And I mean, there was a coworker on the team that literally cursed out customers more than once. You know, I listened to the recordings of this stuff and, you know, and I was just amazed. I'm like, why is this guy still employed? Why? Because he was buddy-buddy with that boss that I told you about. You know, they were besties. They hung out after work and stuff like that. And so he got by with stuff, and I was like, there is no way in hell I would ever be able to get by with that. If I did that same thing, I would be fired on the spot, you know. You know, that's the kind of stuff that it still goes on. That wasn't that long ago. You know, and that's when in 2018, the end of 2017 into 2018, I was transferred onto a different team. I was kind of borrowed on that team, Active Directory team, and reporting to a male boss and then a male coworker, you know, that I actually really respected him. He actually stood up for me a lot of times. But, like, you know, it was one of those things where that boss, you know, I would bring up an issue or, you know, I'd have a ticket with an issue that, you know, only our boss had the high enough access to be able to troubleshoot and figure out what's causing the problem, you know, because it's a, you know, he was the only one. He was the admin, you know, numero uno of Active Directory, right? And so I would have, you know, I got to the point where I'm like, dude, I have like 10 tickets that are sitting there waiting. I got people that are getting frustrated with me because I'm able to solve this problem, and I've reached out to you 3 times via email so far, letting you know of these problems, and I would not even get a response, you know. But yet my male counterpart, you know, he would always get a response almost immediately. And then, you know, it got to the point where at one point there was a conference call because the people that were so frustrated that had been waiting to get this problem fixed went up the chain, you know, went up above my boss's head, you know, my then boss, and get on this conference call. And my boss sits there and pretends like this is the first he's heard of the issue. And I was fuming. I mean, it was everything that I could muster within myself not to just completely blow up on this conference call, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, and to protect his image, I didn't say anything. But after the conference call, again, I went to my previous boss and I said, you know, I can't work with this guy anymore. He sat there and pretended like he had no idea. This is the first he's heard of the problem. And I forwarded all 3 of my emails, you know, that presenting him with the problems and the tickets that I had on it, and the emails from the people, you know, with those tickets being frustrated because they still have this problem. They've been waiting and waiting and stuff like that. I'm like, you know, And so again, you know, it wasn't too much longer after that, you know, and my boss actually helped me craft an email, my former boss, right? Because I wrote this scathing email that I was about ready to send, and I sent it to my previous boss, who was a good boss, and I said, you know, I'll probably commit political suicide if I actually send this, but, you know, this is how mad I am. And so my former boss helped me recraft it, and he's like, okay, I want you to CC me, you know, and, you know, copy me on it and stuff. And it was recrafted in a very professional way, listing, you know, the actual data, you know, like how many tickets I have, my communications, you know, why it is above my level of access to be able to troubleshoot this to solve it, stuff like that. And a week goes by, there's no response. And then my former boss said, okay, you know, do a follow-up, you know, and ask him, you know, if he's received your message and if he's had a chance to take a look at what the problem is. And so I did, again, copying my former boss on it. And again, a week goes by again, no word, no response. And so then my former boss, the third time, replies back and goes, is there any movement on this? I'm just going back to, you know, he just, you know, gave it the ploy that, hey, I'm going through my, you know, my emails of stuff that hasn't been resolved yet, and I wanted to follow up. Has there been any progress on this? And then that guy even ignored that. And so it was like, what the hell? And so again, not much longer later, I went back to my former boss again. You know, they changed my role back over, so I went back on my original team, back over to my former boss. And then it was about 2 months after that that bad boss left the company. I think he was given a choice. You know, you can either quit, you know, and we'll give you some time to find another job, or we're going to fire you, you know. I really suspect that that's what happened, because I think that my good boss that was in that loop went up the chain and said, you know, this is what's happening. And I'm like, you know, and it wasn't the first time, you know, it type of a thing either, that this type of scenario had happened with this guy. And so, yeah, I mean, like, that's what you deal with. It's like, you know, what other reason is there, you know, when I'm completely ignored, but yet my male counterpart always got a response right away, always got the extra time, you know, for like, hey, I need you to show me this or that, you know, that preferential treatment, you know. And it's like, what, you know, because I have tits, you know, you ignore me? Is that what we're dealing with here? Because it certainly seemed like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could be, or it could be the fact that even if you were a guy, the same situation might have happened. You could have been ignored anyhow. It could be because you're a woman, or it could be because of other issues. We have only 4 minutes left. What I'm going to do is unmute. Did he drop? Okay, he dropped. Okay, so I'm not going to unmute anybody.
Yeah, it looks like he dropped.
Okay. So, Lorianne, if you want to carry on, if Joe and Warren want to stay on for the extra hour, and see if we go into the extra hour, that's fine. But I'm getting off. Okay.
I'm getting off too, Joe. I got to go to bed here. I'm getting off here.
Okay. Joe, are you coming to stay in or what? Huh? Joe,
are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, are you staying with Lorianne or what? Because I presume you're going into double overtime, Lorianne.
Yeah, that's long enough for me for tonight then.
Okay.
It's all good.
Just two of us left? Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah,
I was up
at
3 o'clock in the morning,
you know.
Yesterday, I think.
Yeah. You're still recovering.
Yeah, I need some sleep.
Yeah. All right. Well, guys, Lorianne, thanks again for being my co-host. And And you were pretty good, even though you were a woman. So I think it's time for...
Even though you're a woman. You're a pretty good co-host.
even though you're a woman. All right,
thanks
so
for the pat
is...
on the back and the bitch slap at the same time. I like how you worked that in.
Right.
You know? So we shall see what we come up with for next week. Talk to you later, y'all. Good night.